We are back. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is with me, and we are both with Alan Dershowitz. I did feel at one point in the book that I was dealing with a very crafty lawyer.
Uh-huh.
I was about three quarters of the way through, and all of a sudden you say to me that the Bible justifies laws, and it had the people of Abraham, the children of Abraham, are people reluctant to accept laws without a reason, which takes us to democracy.
Right.
Boom.
Uh-huh.
Well, suddenly I was able to, it sort of shifted the focus in and out. Oh, let's see. One has to have the laws and have a tradition of law and be willing to challenge, and then take us to the responsibility part, all of which ends up with a platform on which democracy can grow. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I agree. I think that the seeds of democracy are in questioning authority, and the seeds of democracy are in requiring authority to justify. When you have Bishop Tutu recently said the only totalitarian that's legitimate in the world is God, I disagree. I think the God that I admire is a God who's not a totalitarian, a God who ceded some of his authority to his creatures and said, let's have a contract. I'll do this for you, you do this for me. And there was a great story that
it's
I love.
Very different.
Very different. Yeah.
Sorry, there's a great story. We like stories.
Great story I love about a rabbi. His name is Rabbi Levi Yitzchak. He lived at about the same time of the establishment of the United States, 1776. Times were very bad for Jews in where he lived in Russia. And he sued God. He brought a lawsuit against God for breaking the covenant. And he convened a group of rabbis and said, I'm suing God. Here, I'm filing papers against him. Let him defend himself. If any of you want to defend him, he's broken his covenant. He promised us that if we loved him and obeyed him, he would do good things for us. And look at what we've had, pogroms and the Crusades and the Inquisitions. God, you better answer. And of course, the story ends by saying the court ruled that God was guilty, and then they all prayed to God. I mean, that's part of a wonderful tradition.
That's an astounding tradition.
Right.
This is striking. I think a lot of us tend to think that history began with the founding of this country, or you know,
wrong.
In 1950, or or the day we were born, or a month before that. That's ancient history. What you're describing, and particularly as you bring it into the context of democracy, there's much of the world that has not reached that stage yet, that mm-hmm. is still in a condition of the arbitrary use of power.
Right.
And sometimes those that have reached that stage revert to that.
Oh, of course.
Well, it's, as you say, it's a constant struggle, but it is striking that, you know, what we're describing is archaic prehistory, essentially. Particularly Genesis, trying to struggle with these very ill-formed notions and put words around them and structure to them and find a way that it works, still characterizes, I think, much of the thinking and really much of the politics that mm-hmm. is present in the world at large. It's not as if we're a long way from, this is not ancient history. This is still today.
Well, you know, if you do a little study of how long human beings have been on the earth compared to how long the earth has been in existence, you know, we're a fingernail at the very end of a very long corridor. And when we think about democracy, democracy is so recent in world history and so infrequently applied. I mean, people get upset at me when I say that democracy and liberty and justice is not the human norm. Throughout history, the human norm has been totalitarianism, censorship, oppression, warfare, undemocratic means. And that's why the struggle is so great. And yet you find an old book like this, and it's struggling toward democracy, not quite the democracy that we understand.
But the predicates.
But the predicates are there. And I call them justificatory laws. Justificatory laws. It's a big word. But laws that require justification. Do it because. Do it not because I told you so. Not the way a parent teaches a child early on. But laws that explanatory laws, based on the experiences of the people. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, the life of the law is not logic, it's experience. And I think the book of Genesis is the predicate for making experience the life of the law.
Well, and what, back to those stories, isn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and what you're describing is laws of legitimacy,
mm-hmm.
legitimization of laws emerging out of the social group, the community. rather than being imposed by God, by dictator, by fiat, by some arbitrary mechanism. And that's a radical shift.
It's a radical shift. It's the bottom up rather than the top down. It's not the trickle-down theory of law. It's the grass growing, let 1,000 flowers bloom, let 1,000 menorahs light their candles. We're never going to get complete agreement about law. Or about how to resolve issues. There's a case in the Supreme Court now. I love this case in the Supreme Court. It's a case involving a husband and wife have a baby. The husband then dies. The wife remarries. The late husband's parents, the grandparents of the child, want to visit the child. The new husband and the wife say, no, we don't want them to visit. They say they have a natural right to visit their grandchild. The parents say, we have a natural right to bring up our child the way we want to without any interference from grandparents or from the state. Who wins? I mean, here you have the clash of natural rights. There's no law on the subject. We have to go back to basics to answer that kind of question, and there's no right and wrong answer. It's on the one hand, on the other hand. You know, Harry Truman once said, please let me find a one-handed lawyer. Stop saying to me on the one hand, on the other hand.
A one-handed lawyer,
well,
that's
and it's
great.
At that point that you start looking for Solomon yet again.
Well, and you say Solomon isn't readily available most of the time.
He's
which
not
maybe is why
available.
We need the law.
Right. And, you know, if every judge were Solomon, we wouldn't need laws. But every judge is not a Solomon. And we need rules. We need laws. And Jesus was right when he came in and said, look, too many laws. It's getting too technical. Every so often, you need deformalization. And then Muhammad comes along and says, but Jesus was a little too lax. Let's reinstitute some laws. You get a process. And that process is begun in the book of Genesis and continued throughout human history.
I want you to talk some more about responsibility, because you say even the idea of responsibility changes over time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How does that happen?
In the beginning, every clan and tribe and family are responsible for all of their members. If one member of the clan sins, every member of the clan is punished. The story of Dina. Dina is seduced or raped, we're not clear, by Shechem, who loves her, who falls in love with her.
But he's a not Jew.
He's not Jewish, and that raises some problem, but he agrees to be circumcised. That's a heavy price to pay. And everybody in his clan agrees to be circumcised. Nonetheless, the brothers of Dina go and kill everybody in the clan. Collective responsibility. We reject that in our society. But the Ten Commandments accepts it. It says that if you sin against me, your sin will be imposed on your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. Later, the book of Deuteronomy, which is thought to be a later book, says, no, only the sin of the father shall be on himself and on the children on themselves. Nobody should be responsible for the sins of others. So we see a development,
here.
A progression of responsibility. And, you know, you needed to have some generational responsibility in order to really punish people. Sometimes if people are old, you can't say, if you do this, I'm going to really punish you. Yeah, what are you going to punish me? I'm dying anyway. Well, we're going to punish you through your children. I wrote a novel last year called Just Revenge about a Holocaust survivor who can't take revenge against the man who killed his whole family because the man is dying, but he tries to take revenge against his child. That's the ultimate revenge, but it's unjust.
Where are we now in that?
We're still questing for justice. I mean, individual responsibility. Take Columbine. We're just celebrating its, you know, anniversary. What a terrible anniversary to celebrate. Yet,
at least marking it. I'm
right,
not sure celebrating
right. No,
it.
That's a very good distinction. And there's a quest to hold responsible the parents. The children who did the killing are dead. We can't do anything to them. But we want to broaden the responsibility. We're frustrated that we can't get at the killers. So we're trying to get at their parents. Are parents responsible for their children's actions?
And you find this as a lawyer.
Yeah. Oh, all the time. Yeah. People try to... If there's a dead body, somebody has to pay for it. And even if we can't figure out who it is, we'll find somebody. You can't have unresolved crimes. That really throws society for a loop.
It seems to me that, you know, part of the cure for this is what you've tried to do, and I think succeeded in with this book, to the extent that the body politic has a richer sense of the dynamic of justice, the predicates of justice, and the ambiguity of justice. It would seem that it is possible in a society to be able to find justice more readily than if you are dependent on a codified step-by-step, if-then-else paragraph, subparagraph.
I agree, and that's why I prefer the American common law system to the European system of codification. I think codification creates static approach to law. You write all the codes, you think you've done it, it's all resolved. Common law constantly has to move and change. You know, the original title for my book, it was too much of a mouthful, was The Genesis of Justice in the Injustice of Genesis.
Oh, but it's a great title.
Well, because you can't find justice without first seeing injustice. Justice is a reaction to injustice. That's why the book of Genesis is so full of stories of injustice. All early law books are full of injustice, and that's how we build justice.
This is also, and this is, I think, part of the frustration, particularly in a time that is so technology-driven, we want law to be a science. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to write the equations and say, this is just, this is unjust, and to be able to put in data, turn the crank, and become able to come out with a decision.
We even call our advanced degree Doctor of Juridical Science, but it's not true. Law will never be a science.
This comes from Alan Dershowitz, who teaches law at Harvard, so he should know. We'll all be back in just a moment for a couple more minutes with Alan Dershowitz. Please be with us when we return with The Paula Gordon Show.